Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club for the first function of the year for the Sydney Institute, and it's great to have Senator Erica Batts Abetz back at the Institute. I think it's the third occasion on which he's addressed us, and he is most welcome. You know him well, so I will introduce him briefly. He trained as a lawyer. He joined the Senate in February 1994, so he's very close to 20 years. He had senior role in the Howard government as a minister. He was deputy leader and then leader of the opposition during the time of the Rudd and Gillard governments, and he became leader of the government in the Senate following the election of the coalition last September. And at the moment, Senator Betts holds the current positions of Minister for Employment and Minister Assisting the Prime Minister on the Public Service. And tonight, Senator Abetz is going to talk to the Institute on the topic industrial relations after the 30 Years' War. Erica Betts, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Gerard. When Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg, the reverberations ultimately led to a major war between Protestants and Catholics, the 30 Years' War. As a Protestant, I won't blame Luther for starting the war. Workplace relations devotees might say that when Gerard Henderson posted his 9-page Industrial Relations Club thesis in the pages of Quadrant in 1983, it had similar but a lot more immediate consequences. In the case of Australia's 30 Years' War in industrial relations, I lay the blame squarely at the feet of our host, Gerard Henderson, who 30 years ago, on a late August afternoon in 1983, as he tells it, quote, decided to drop a bucket on the system. His essay in Quadrant coined the now famous phrase, the Industrial Relations Club, and started a debate unprecedented in its vigour. Ever since, our host has been at the forefront of public policy thinking. His writings are always worth a read, and his appearances on the ABC are always worth a listen, but just far too rare. Having triggered a major conflagration 30 years ago, there is still no Australian workplace relations equivalent of the Peace of Westphalia. Albeit, we did have the ceasefire of 2010, where neither side of politics released a workplace relations policy, it seemed everyone was battle-weary. Prior to the Henderson thesis, the Industrial Relations Club in Australia was exceptionally comfortable, too comfortable to the detriment of workers' business viability and the economic well-being of our nation. The thought process of the club, as described by Henderson, discounted the importance of the individual, the enterprise, society, and the economy. Can I ask rhetorically, in the Industrial Relations Club view of the world, who stands up for the individual? Who stands up for the individual enterprise? Who stands up for society? Who stands up for the unemployed? Who stands up for the economy's needs? Those who were spurred on to argue for reform, emboldened by the Henderson thesis, spoke of the need to consider the needs of individual enterprises on the basis that one size does not always fit all. It was not long before it appeared that every parrot in every pet shop, with apologies to Paul Keating, was squawking enterprise bargaining, and so some vital reforms were commenced. This transformation within Labor was significant, given Keating's predecessor labelled such thinking as that of, quote, economic troglodytes. Peter Reith built on those modest Keating reforms from 1996 onwards. We then witnessed the Howard government's reforms in its final term of office. The coalition's misadventures in relation to workplace relations reform following the 2004 election are well known. The key lesson learned from this experience is that the path to substantial and lasting reform does not lie on one side of politics exceeding its electoral mandate and implementing change for which the community is not prepared. I emphasise that this lesson applies equally to Labor. From 2007, the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments, having promised to wind back the excesses whilst retaining a modern system, could not resist the urge to reinstitute the Industrial Relations Club and ultimately wound back the system to its pre-Keating status. It's interesting to put the recent actions of Bill Shorten and the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments into some historical perspective. In the 1980s, early on in the 30 Years' War, the Hawke government implemented the Accord, which sought to use the machinery of the existing centralised wage-fixing system to achieve wage restraint and prevent reckless union claims from ruining a fragile economy. It involved a comparatively economically literate Labor government and an accommodating ACTU leadership looking beyond the interests of the IR Club and belatedly accepting responsibility for ensuring that their actions did not jeopardise jobs. The ACTU's leaders, for their part, accepted wage restraint for the greater good in return for other commitments. They were not so reckless as to think that their role was simply to squeeze a Labor government to provide every item on their wish list, and Bob Hawke and Paul Keating would not have acquiesced. Martin Ferguson articulated that position well when he wrote just last year, quote, "In my 20 years as a union official, I was always mindful of the economic conditions facing employers. Wage claims that do not consider market conditions with no productivity improvements do not serve anyone well over the longer term, and all they ultimately do is price the sons and daughters of current workers out of a job." End of quote. Despite the flaws of the Accord approach, we should acknowledge that the Labor Party and the union movement were not oblivious to the broader national interest. The last Labor government, particularly with Bill Shorten as minister, was characterised by its granting of an unseemly range of union wish list claims. Some of the reasons for this have recently come to light. On the 18th of November, Peter Harcher wrote of a secret Kirribilli agreement. Harcher's account of this deal is highly illuminating, and allow me to quote. "Much as Gillard forged alliances to support her government against Abbott, she forged an alliance with the trade union movement to support her government against Abbott and defend herself against Rudd. In November 2011, Gillard hosted a meeting with the secretary of the ACTU, Dave Oliver, and the heads of the major unions. It was held over lunch at Kirribilli House. Its purpose was to forge a strategic alliance between Gillard and the union movement. It was another Kirribilli agreement," says Martin Ferguson, referring to the notorious secret deal where Bob Hawke promised to hand over the Labor leadership to Paul Keating. "It was the death knell for her government. She gave the unions everything they wanted." Dave Oliver began the meeting with a log of demands. A discussion followed. Gillard responded by setting up a machinery for working on key items, according to participants. End of the quote. The results following the meeting are now well known. Far from running a Labor government that engaged in grown-up negotiations with the union leadership, Ms. Gillard took on the role of Santa Claus. And if Julia Gillard played the role of Santa Claus, then Mr. Shorten as minister was, for his part, Santa's most obedient little helper. In the period that he was the minister, Labor delivered countless favours for the union bosses, the most high profile being the minister's address to the Maritime Union of Australia self-styled militancy conference celebrating 140 years of law-breaking and thuggery, where he gave them emphatic support. In contrast, just last week, Martin Ferguson said, "There are some sections of the community who have no appreciation of the changing circumstances, such as the Maritime Union in the offshore industry." But back to Mr. Shorten and the wish list. The stacking of the Fair Work Commission, the creation of two new vice presidents of the Fair Work Commission, the abolition of the Australian Building and Construction Commission, something which is very topical today, reclassifying out workers in the textile, clothing and footwear sectors as employees at the insistence of the relevant union, tying the majority of a $1.2 billion package in aged care funding to union enterprise agreements which favoured the health services union, and exactly the same but with $300 million for childcare subsidies for the benefit of United Voice. Pursuing the ratification of ILO conventions that had not been deemed worthy of ratification by every federal government from Whitlam onwards, and one of them Whitlam wouldn't even ratify. In breach of specific election promises, the right to entry was expanded, and, might I add, the minister was silent when the CFMEU was found guilty of 30 counts of contempt of court by the Victorian Supreme Court. Justice Hayden of the High Court stated that Minister Shorten was acting, and I quote, "as a partisan and not as an intervener in the Barclay-Bendigo TAFE case." And the list goes on. I should add that of the legislative and policy changes listed above, only one of them was taken to an election. Some of them were in fact directly contrary to election promises. So far from embracing the spirit of the Hawke-Keating reform legacy, the current ALP has more in common with the Caldwell-Whitlam legacy in terms of its economic ineptitude and subservience to union bosses. As one final example, I cite the sad tale of individual flexibility arrangements. This idea of the individual having distinctive rights has been one of the most fought over during the 30 Years' War. As long ago as 1996, Bob Hawke commented that, and I quote, "for its part, the trade union movement must recognise the right of an employer and an employee freely to enter into individual contracts underpinned by an independently determined safety net." Prior to the 2007 election, Julia Gillard had initially promised to sweep away all individual agreements, but ultimately took the more pragmatic path of promising, and I quote, "under Labor's new collective enterprise bargaining system, all collective agreements will be required to contain a flexibility clause, which provides that an employer and an individual employee can make a flexibility arrangement." The reality fell far short, and the overwhelming majority of employers and employees simply ignored them as offering no practical benefit to either side. Indeed, unfortunately, the very concept of individual flexibility, even in a collective framework, and even if the employee is better off, is still vigorously opposed by the union movement. Which I suppose brings us to the present day and what the future holds under the coalition. Getting workplace relations policy wrong can destroy a nation's economy. Conversely, getting it right can help to build a nation's economy. Getting workplace relations policy wrong can destroy a household budget. Conversely, getting it right can help to build a household budget. And it's that intersection of the macro and micro that I personally find so very challenging in the workplace space. In short, balance, guided by the wider and social interest, which includes the individual, is the key. In approaching the subject of future reform, I am conscious of the lessons of history. In workplace relations, the most effective and most lasting reforms are those that are undertaken carefully and cautiously, where the case for change is made out in advance. The Coalition released its policy in May of last year, well in advance of the election. It sought to address a number of key problems with the Fair Work Act and to return the pendulum to the sensible centre. For the purposes of tonight, I don't intend to take you through the 38-page policy document. Suffice to say, we are committed to its implementation. The last 30 years has shown that, in this portfolio more than any other, lasting reform only truly takes hold where a process of rigorous debate takes place and the change is not unexpected. Only then, when the case for change is properly made out, will one side of the partisan divide accept the legitimacy of the other side's reforms, rather than simply seeking to undo them as soon as the opportunity arises. A further lesson of history is that too much emphasis has been placed on the IR Club, of satisfying the so-called members and participants. If the employer and employee were agreed, there was practically nothing for the Commission to consider. This was painfully obvious with the approach taken by the Commission to the issue of default superannuation funds named in the so-called modern awards. It won't surprise to learn that the parties consented to the naming of, in particular, various industry funds as the default funds from which employer and employee organisations or their representatives obtained handsome board fees. In 1983, Gerard Henderson wrote that no effective attempt can be made to achieve long-term reforms in industrial relations unless due consideration is given to the role and attitudes of the IR Club. Club members should be made responsible for the consequences of their actions. End of quote. One of the first things I learned in relation to this portfolio is that the most important driver of outcomes is actually the actions of the participants themselves. As Shadow Minister, it was always disappointing to see weak-kneed employers caving into unreasonable union demands and then visiting me advocating for change in the system. And now as Minister, this phenomenon has unfortunately become even more frustrating. I have often wondered why employers couldn't just say no from the outset. But I have also wondered why the union bosses continue to push the envelope in making unsustainable demands, even when they know that it will ultimately end in their own members losing their jobs. The thing is that union bosses who push the envelope too far don't actually have anything on the line personally. Like at the Burnie paper mill in my home state of Tasmania, where ultimately all the workers lost their jobs with the mill closing and the union officials found their way into Parliament. On the other hand, with most large employers, it is actually employees conducting the bargaining on behalf of the employer. It's not their own money, and again, they don't have anything directly at stake either. It is of great concern to the Coalition that unions and employers have inserted unproductive and expensive clauses into enterprise agreements, particularly where the taxpayer is subsidising the sector. In February 2012, The Australian reported under the bold headline, Holden signs record pay deal, unions win 22% wage hike as carmaker seeks taxpayer handouts. The report contained extracts of a circular sent by the unions to Holden members, basically saying how wonderful it was, and to simply quote, in the automotive sector, it represents the best deal yet to be negotiated. For what it's worth, the day after the Holden wage deal was announced, I had this to say. When the trade union bosses boast that they've got huge wage rises without a productivity trade-off, taxpayers are entitled to ask whether they are getting value for money, and whether the company is genuinely engaged in transforming itself to stand alone. And I went on to talk about the huge job losses, and it's a view I still hold. Shortly after, I received what I'll call an educative letter from Holden, which told me that claims that have been made are simply not true. I was told that it was a groundbreaking agreement in Australian automotive manufacturing that would significantly improve our productivity. This landmark agreement was so good and so productive that it included more than double the award rate for apprentices, a so-called hardship payment of $3,750 in lump sum handouts to employees, and the list goes on. Barely 1 month later, Ms. Gillard announced an additional $275 million subsidy for Holden, which she claimed would guarantee the manufacturing operations in Australia until 2022. A rough back-of-the-envelope calculation suggested that much of Ms. Gillard's new funding would simply go towards paying the excessive wage increases. Since 1994, Holden has provided 11 wage increases above the equivalent quarter average annualised wage increase for both the manufacturing industry and all industries. Over the last 12 years alone, Holden has received more than $2 billion in taxpayer funding from the Commonwealth and states. And now, Holden has announced its departure from manufacturing. The union movement has been desperate to rationalise its role. The ACTU Secretary Dave Oliver's last role was as Secretary of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, the union covering car industry workers. Paul Keating once said of one of Mr. Oliver's predecessors, George Campbell, that he carried the scalps of 100,000 unemployed metal workers around his neck, in reference to the early 1980s wage explosion that his union had initiated. Mr. Oliver and the union leadership owe it to their constituency to seriously consider whether they wish to be similarly responsible for the scalps of thousands of auto workers. While a range of factors clearly have contributed to Holden's decision, it's very clear that workplace relations helped increase the pressures. More recently, Toyota has sought to vary its enterprise agreement to remove a number of restrictive clauses. But even before the workers could have their say, the federal court frustrated this exercise upon an application from the union. Becoming more productive and thereby providing job security is clearly beneficial for the workers, not only of Toyota, but of the many companies that supply Toyota. The government supports their efforts. Some of the issues that Toyota have sought to deal with is reducing the Christmas shutdown period from 21 to 10 days, reducing the number of paid days leave to attend union delegate training from 10 days per year to 5 days in the first year and 2 days in subsequent years, and so the list goes on. On a calculation of just two of the aspects of that enterprise agreement, we could reinsert into the Toyota workforce 2,000 productive working days just by removing some of those agreements. So it does beg the question that management does need to accept responsibility, but it's deeply troubling that the employees' right to vote on the proposed variations has been frustrated. It's clearly in the public interest that workers be allowed to vote on Toyota's proposed variations and determine their own destiny. So tonight I announce that I have decided to intervene in support of Toyota workers being allowed a say as soon as possible on the proposed variation. Of course, these restrictive practices are not only in the auto sector. The MUA has been engaged in wage negotiations with Total Marine Services. A 30% wage increase was granted, And when questioned, the government of the day said the government welcomes Total Marine and the MUA reaching a new enterprise agreement. We welcome that. That was in an answer to me in the Senate. There was no regard for the potential impact, not just at that company, but also for the flow-on effects in the industry. I would simply point to the adage by former Labor Treasurer Frank Crean that one man's pay rise is another man's job. Still in Western Australia, the Fair Work Ombudsman prosecuted the MUA and Offshore Marine Services over a no-ticket, no-start policy. When questioned about this, they claimed it was to keep industrial peace. Winston Churchill's adage that peace without honour will not be lasting peace is apposite. In contrast, there have been responsible employers who have said no and for whom the price was significant. Most famously, Fred Stouder of Dollar Sweets fought one of the early pitched battles of the 30 Years' War and prevailed over a mindless 5-month picket at his Dollar Sweets business in 1985. More recently, Daniel Grollo stood up valiantly to the violent besetting of his construction sites in Melbourne by the CFMEU. And similarly, Mike Kane of Boral has stood up to the CFMEU in relation to boycotts, with the concrete being delivered to GroCon sites. These are three examples of employers who have had the resolve to say no. But there is clearly much that still needs to change in Australia's industrial relations culture. As Gerard Henderson said in 1983, the approach of club members to unlawful strikes is invariably to, quote, urge moderation and further talks leading to additional concessions. They are all for the carrot and see no role for the stick, end of quote. Instead of agitating for reform to outlaw certain tactics, why can't employers just say no? The benefits of determined action by employers were seen in the successful High Court challenge to the draconian New South Wales workplace safety laws in the Kirk decision in 2010. What puzzled me was why it took employers a full decade to finally challenge those laws. As you might imagine, there are other aspects to my speech which I will pass over. Suffice to say that the Modern Award Review is an opportunity for the Commission to actually make the awards as to what Gerard Henderson, Paul Keating and others thought should be the case, namely short and concise. What we still have in some of the modern awards, regrettably, is a whole degree of specificity, including in the building award. There are 69 separate allowances enumerated in that award. So good luck with a four-year review and the Fair Work Commission. And I hope a lot of small businesses and individuals have the capacity to have an input, and it's not just left to the Industrial Relations Club. Workplace relations should be a genuine enterprise between government, employers and employees. While self-interest will always play a part, can I appeal to a higher interest, the long-term sustainability of jobs, wages and our economy? As Minister, I'm committed to playing my part and working in the national interest, not in sectional interests. It is up to the participants to step up to the mark and play their part as well. We must be wary of the IR Club's ethos of complacency and self-congratulation, described by Gerard Henderson 30 years ago, in which economic realities take what is very much second place, if that. I am conscious that tonight I have stepped into a field in which debate and controversy over future reform has swung backwards and forwards for three decades. If we are to achieve a lasting peace settlement after our 30 years' war, such a settlement has to be predicated on moving away from the dichotomy of two innately hostile sides within the club, for ever doing expedient deals to temporarily ameliorate the hostility. Employers and unions must be encouraged to take responsibility for the cost of their deals, not just the cost to the affected enterprises, but the overall cost in relation to our economic efficiency and the creation of opportunities for others. If this is not done, then we risk seeing something akin to the wages explosion of the pre-accord era, when unsustainable wage growth simply pushed thousands of Australians out of work. If the system is not driving the parties to act more responsibly, then it needs to be reformed so that it does. But even with the system's faults, there is nothing stopping participants acting responsibly. Indeed, some of the representations I receive could best be categorised as a desperate plea to protect the participant from themselves. Under any peace settlement, the system should be accessible and intelligible to all, not just IR Club members. The system of workplace rights must be matched by an equal recognition of responsibilities. When parties breach their legal obligations, they should be in no doubt that an effective system of sanctions will apply. It should go without saying that illegal and indeed criminal behaviour that would not be tolerated in any other setting should not be excused because it occurs in an industrial context. The system should be one in which the concept of enterprise bargaining once again reflects the intent for which it was first introduced. Certain unions, on the one hand, see it as an opportunity to simply ratchet up wages and conditions, whilst many employers approach the next round of bargaining with a sense of dread and adopt a strategy of harm minimisation with little prospect of improving their competitive position. Finally, both sides of politics have to accept that labour and capital both have a role to play and should not see their role in government as to simply further the interests of one at the expense of the other. There ought to be scope for all parties to accept the settlement along these lines. When I consider the approach articulated by Paul Keating in 1993, it's impossible to avoid the conclusion that a peace settlement that acknowledged modern realities would have been much more possible with the Labor politicians of his generation than his successors 20 years hence. As Minister for Employment, I see my role as being Minister for Jobs. Putting in place a system that is fair and reasonable for all and which promotes sustainable prosperity through sustainable and rewarding jobs. Whilst the same degree of fervour has embraced the participants of both 30 years' wars, I trust that after the 30 years of hostility in the latter war, it can similarly be resolved. And that is one of my tasks. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to the Minister for a thoughtful and very detailed speech. Eric Betts has obviously cut his speech in about half, and I think your paper will be up on your website from tonight, and will be published in the Sydney Papers online in due course. There's some chairs around. There's two chairs up here, wonderful chairs up here, and there's some chairs around the back over there. Yeah, there are chairs. Before we come to questions and discussion, could I just say once again thanks to Gallipoli Club, the renovated Gallipoli Club. It looks in great order and we're very pleased to be here in this great facility so close to our office. So thanks to the Gallipoli Club for providing this facility. I just lead off the first question. I think you announced tonight that you're going to intervene in the Toyota case. And you also said that you regarded yourself as the Minister for Jobs. I don't know how much you can say about the planned intervention, but as I read Justice Morty Bromberg's decision in the Toyota case, he, being a judge who gives a great deal of vent to when he sits in other jurisdictions, to human rights, but here he was seen to be saying that workers at Toyota had no right whatsoever to vote on a proposed change to their existing agreement, that the workforce didn't have any rights, that the rights had already been negotiated away by the union leadership and the management. So what's going to be the nature of your response to that?
As with all interventions, it shouldn't be on the basis of partisanship, but more intervening on the basis of the interpretation of the actual law. And it is the government's view that the actual law in this situation did not require the restrictive interpretation that is on it placed on these provisions and the provision, most importantly, in the enterprise agreement. And so it will revolve around that as to whether the agreement of itself did stop further negotiation of changes if actually both parties agreed. But of course it's one of these situations where the employer signed and the union signed for and on behalf of the workers. But if that is the law, if that is the way that these clauses are to be interpreted in the future, then I believe it's in the public interest to ensure that if that is what the courts ultimately determine, that we then deal with it to open these agreements up for flexibility. Because at the end of the day, surely workers are entitled to have their say to vote either yes or no on the proposition that Toyota wants to put to them to, one assumes, save their jobs.
Don't stand in front of the camera here.
Minister, just on the Toyota issue. So first of all, prior to the election, about 6 months earlier than that, you made the comment that you made here today, and that was that, you know, you're sick of employers coming and reading to you about how terrible it all is and why isn't someone doing something to help it? Well, you know, I absolutely endorse that. I absolutely endorse your the point you made then and the point you made now. Now, the point of Toyota is this, is Toyota has agreed to those things. Now, you know, I have a particular point of view about Justice Bromberg and the wisdom of his decisions, but the fact are, Toyota agreed that these things aren't to be opened. Now, I mean, for God's sake, how do we help? How do you help? How does anyone help a major corporation like Toyota when they are so stupid, you know, to willingly go and do this?
It's okay, the question is, just in case the podcast didn't pick it up, how do you help Toyota, it having made that agreement?
Well, Toyota has to be responsible for its own decisions, as I sought to say in the speech, but what I would invite you all to reflect upon is, chances are Toyota did not come up with that clause itself. Chances are it was union-initiated and a big company like Toyota agreed to it. And if that is correct, and I'm assuming it is, just imagine if the union were to pay a visit to a lot smaller enterprise where they don't employ lawyers, where the boss actually works the machines as well, and that employer is then told, even Toyota has got this in their enterprise agreement, how dare you stand in the way, and as a result, a degree of sort of a pattern emerges, if I can use that terminology, and as a result restricts workplaces right around the country, and that is why these decisions and these agreements don't only impact on the particular enterprise itself, but has reverberations into other workplaces, and that's what is of great concern to myself.
Question down there.
Further to that line of argument.
You can stand up to your number.
I think I recall Hugh Morgan, who was the CEO of once of Western Mining, saying that when he stood up, when Western Mining stood up to the unions, probably the only one of the 90s of the mining companies who did, it cost the company something like $300 million.
The suggestion is that employers do stand up, it costs them financially.
You've tried to debate with employers tonight about their lack of will in standing up to unions, but it's very costly.
Well, look, as a young lawyer, I flew over to Melbourne to work with my mates, Michael Kroger and Peter Costello, on the Dollar Sweets case, and I remember meeting Fred Stouder, rest his soul, who was very, very brave to stand up to the unions, but it cost him emotionally and monetarily in a very, very substantial way. And in the end, it was the Melbourne Chamber of Commerce and others who were willing to chip in to make a stand in relation to this particular matter that actually allowed the court case to proceed. Fred Stouder would not have had the personal capacity, financial capacity, to fight all the way that he did. And similarly, with the Kirk case going to the High Court, that required the, if I recall, the National Farmers Federation and a few other organisations chipping in to allow that case to proceed. And if I might say, when there are test cases of this nature, the trade union movement, they know what's unity is strength. Employers might like to learn that lesson as well. And if I might give a little anecdote which outlines the difficulty some employers have. In my role with Fred Stouder and Dollar Sweets, I remember visiting another confectionery business saying, any whispers from the unions, are there any difficulties with you supplying Dollar Sweets, etc.? The managing director leant back in his chair and said, young man, people still refer to me as young man in those days, he said, young man, why should I be concerned if Dollar Sweets goes bust? That means another 2-3% of the market is opened up for us. And whilst that is the mentality of employers, we will continue to see some of the problems that we're talking about tonight.
Question right down the back.
Lisa, thank you for your comments, Mark. In terms of taking the conversation forward in the next 3 years about the cause of the industrial relations reform, what do businesses, NGOs, community groups, how should they be thinking to assist each other and the government so that perhaps in 3 years and then henceforth we're in a slightly different position on taking the course forward?
What I would invite the community at large, be it NGOs, employers, anybody, to simply ask the question, what is or are the long-term consequences of this particular decision? It was so obvious in my home state of Tasmania with the Burnie paper mill dispute that the mill was in absolute trouble. The union was belligerent. Indeed, one of the conditions was that the night electrician that they were going to put out to contract, because it'd be a lot cheaper, the night electrician actually had a mattress in the corner because he hardly ever had to work of a night and would sleep of a night at the mill and have a daytime job as well. Now, you know, those sort of practices are unsustainable. There's an old saying, if it's too good to be true, chances are it is too good to be true. But having said all that, how did management in the first place allow those conditions to be acceptable? Because once you give somebody something, taking it away is a lot more difficult than saying in the first place, sorry, this is unaffordable. And there does need to be a stand taken by employers and the community organisations, simply asking the question, is this sustainable? What will this do for future generations? And if I might just observe, thinking out aloud, you know, the Fair Work Commission's recent decision, and look, it's the independent umpire, it made the decision in relation to apprentice wages. I just asked the question, with a rate of youth unemployment in this country, will the substantial increase in apprentice wages help us resolve the youth unemployment problem? Will it see more young people engaged in the trades or less?
There's a question here. Don't stand in front of the camera here.
All right.
Yes.
Senator, you said that getting the workplace relationship wrong is going to destroy the economy. Well, for the average Australian, including possibly residents of the Griffith electorate, they do not see the economy as a repertoire theatre of big business, government, and labour. So what they see is individuals with talents which have to be unleashed with four key incentives. in the economy. So my question is that why isn't that the high personal income tax rates or the carbon tax or sort of that nature and the subsidies, the wasteful government spending, aren't the major factors in destroying the economy, but it is the industrial relation factor.
So there's a question about, well, what about other factors like high marginal tax rates or carbon tax?
Look, I fully agree with the content of the question. It is not only matters workplace relations that will determine the soundness of the economy. You can kill an economy by having excessive taxation, but as Minister for Employment this evening, I've concentrated on matters employment, but some of you who might be media junkies may have heard me respond to Mr. Shorten when he said that he was going to be a leader of the opposition that was going to be promoting jobs and job opportunities. I welcomed that announcement and suggested to him that the first thing he could do is help us in removing the carbon tax, because that would especially be of assistance to the manufacturing sector. So I fully accept that the health of an economy will not only be determined by the workplace relations policy settings, but taxation is clearly another one of the very important settings for providing incentives for the economy. Can I indicate coastal shipping as another? And so the list goes on.
Chris?
Yeah, Scott.
Sorry, I couldn't see you because of the bright light. I was wondering where the voice was coming from, but I've now seen you. Thank you.
The largest employer in the economy is small business. But in all of the arguments and debates that rage and have raged for 30 years, small business really don't feature other than impact at best lip service. But if you want to restore employment opportunities, then you need to create an environment where small companies can innovate, can employ people, can take a risk. They're the guys at the bottom that ultimately employ people in new areas in new ways. And, you know, it's not lost on me, for instance, that the whole debacle with Holt leaving could have probably been at least assisted had other smaller companies had the initiative, had the innovative skills, and had the industrial relations wherewithal to take up new risks. There are some glaringly good examples of where they're diversified and they've done different things, but by and large, people seem to get set in their ways and they're terrified of employing people, and especially after the 6 years of labour. So I'd like your view on where you're going to take them.
The new government has a small business minister, Bruce Bilson, a member for Dunkley. He sits in cabinet. Small business is now part of the Treasury portfolio, and it's vitally important, I believe, that the Treasury portfolio has an understanding of small business. If I might say, whilst I was a lawyer running my own practice, there were two, sometimes three partners in the practice, but basically it was a small business, and I did a lot of work for small businesses in my local community. So I would like to think I also have an understanding, as might I add, does Bruce Bilson, because he used to be a small business person as well. Now, looking after small business is vitally important, and if I might say, you know, increasing the pay of an apprentice might not be that devastating for a major company, but if you're a one-man band, local plumber, who's always put on an apprentice, the number of them that have approached me or electricians that have said to me, well, given the increase, I doubt I'll now be putting on the next round of apprentice, is to me very concerning. And the Fair Work Commission needs to have an understanding of that, and we have indicated that when and if a position arises in the Fair Work Commission, we would dearly like to be able to appoint somebody with some small business experience.
Yes.
Senator, earlier today you were on 2GB and had a lot to say about the CFMEU, which I found very interesting. In your position as leader of the Senate, do you have any confidence of bringing in those reforms prior to the new Senate coming in?
Well, the Australian Building and Construction Commission was a top priority for us. We said during the election campaign we would introduce the legislation in the first week of the Parliament. We did so. It got through the House of Representatives. It is now in the Senate, and the Senate, with a majority of Labor Green, is simply stalling its reintroduction. I would have hoped and thought that today's revelations might make, especially Bill Shorten, reconsider, but when Labor has been the beneficiary of over $6 million worth of largesse from the CFMEU over recent years, and the Greens themselves have been the beneficiaries, it's going to be very difficult to see that they are going to move on this matter despite the revelations. And people might say, what does the Australian Building and Construction Commission do, or what did it do in the past? In the past, when it was up and running, it made 39 separate referrals to individual law enforcement agencies, be it to police, be it to the tax office, etc. And might I add, they pursued both employer and unions alike if they were engaged in illegality. That is what we need, because as I said on Luke Grant's program this afternoon, you can only get a corrupt trade union official if there is an employer giving him or her the money. And so it takes two to tango, and we are very concerned to ensure that if there is corruption, that we deal with both sides of the equation, and that is what our intention is, especially with the reintroduction of the ABCC.
Question.
Senator, could I ask you, also Minister for the Public Service, and Australian Public Service has grown enormously since about mid-Howard term, and especially SES service grew up from about 800 to 1,800 people. What are you proposing to do about it?
The Australian Public Service has grown. It's amazing how the CPSU is somewhat agitated. That's the Community and Public Sector Union is now somewhat agitated about the Coalition's approach, given that when Kevin Rudd ran for government in 2007, he promised, quote, to take a meat axe to the Australian Public Service, only to see it grow by 8% during the six-year period. We are borrowing money from overseas at an unsustainable rate. We've got a burgeoning public service. We went to the election saying that we would seek to reduce the Commonwealth Public Service by 12,000 through natural attrition over the first term. When we opened the books, we discovered that part of Labor's costings included a reduction in the size of the public service of 14,500 people, but did not tell anybody as to the consequences of their money juggling, and the Secretary of the Finance Department disclosed that after the election. So we've now said our 12,000 natural attrition number is parked on the side as we deal with Labor's embedded 14,500 reduction in the public service, which we'll need to deal with. I just wish the CPSU was as harsh on Labor with all this as they are in relation to us. But look, clearly we have to reduce the public service. It's not going to be easy, and might I add, it's very easy to talk about these in numbers of 14,500, 8% growth, but each public servant that we let go, as we will need to, may well be the breadwinner whose income does supply the funding for the home mortgage, for the school fees, etc. So when we make these decisions, it will be exceptionally hard and difficult on individuals, and as a community, we shouldn't forget that.
Ms. Grinchdown, back here. Yes.
Yes, thank you for the tell me this. Are there, at the moment, any influential voices in either the parliamentary ALP or the ACTU who take the moderate,
Well, there was one or in fact two, in fact, if I might say, and they both have left the Parliament, regrettably, and they were both ACTU presidents, Simon Crean and Martin Ferguson. And if I might say, both those gentlemen, whether you agree or disagree with their policies and politics, I think they genuinely made the transition from union official to Minister of the Crown. Mr. Shorten never made that transition and is still acting as he is just an upmarket version of a trade union official. You know, when Martin Ferguson, as Minister for Resources and Tourism, spoke at a tourism conference in Hobart, he was willing to eyeball all the delegates and say, and I think this quote is right, that the key issue facing your sector is penalty rates. And I hope the Fair Work Commission takes that into account in its review of the modern awards. And regrettably, I think it was only 3 or 4 days later, Mr. Shorten presented the government's view, which was no change to any penalty rate in any award. Now, it just seems to me that you know, if Martin Ferguson can see some of the problems, Paul Keating could, it seems as though that old guard did have some economic literacy about them, which is regrettably lacking in the current crop, so which makes it exceptionally difficult. But we've seen that with the carbon tax as well. There were a few brave voices after the election who basically said, look, the carbon tax debate was a bit like the work choices debate. The Coalition said, look, we accept Labor's got a mandate, wave through the Fair Work Act, you know, that's the way democracy runs. And Richard Marles and a few others said, look, you know, let them repeal the carbon tax. But Labor have dug in over an issue that, as we speak, is still costing jobs and increasing the cost of living in our nation in circumstances where a lot of people are finding it difficult to manage their household budget, and in circumstances where a lot of people are concerned about their job security and employers are questioning, especially in manufacturing, whether they can continue.
We've got time for two quick questions. There's one behind. Yes.
There seems to be a lot of conversation over award wages, apprenticeship wages, etc. If you can categorise the foot soldiers in the workforce, I mean, an apprentice wage isn't that high, especially if you have to pay rent, eat, or, you know, have a family, etc. What about scrutiny over middle management and senior management and the types of wages in that level, particularly considering that public companies, senior management, earn a ginormous amount of money, and some directors are on boards, maybe 6 or 7 boards.
Okay.
Is there any scrutiny around this?
Well, there is public scrutiny in as much as it is disclosed, but I must say I do question how some of these salaries are able to be set. And it nearly seems that you know, Joe's got a job over here for $2 million, which justifies the job for $2.1 million over here. So next time round it'll be 2.2 for somebody else. And so it seems to be ever increasing. Now, look, I accept what you say about apprentice wages. They are low, but at the end of the day, you've got to look at the productivity and the capacity to earn an income for the business. And I remember back in the old days when I had just graduated from law school, we in Tasmania had an apprenticeship system for 18 months, and I thought I was being very hardly done by with the lack of money I was receiving. Until later, when I was a lawyer and had my first apprentice, and I realised how much downtime there was in assisting the apprentice to learn the tricks of the trade and where to look for things, etc. And so when you have a look at the actual productivity, if you price an apprentice to an extent where the business can no longer afford it, and keep in mind, especially with small businesses, this money then goes straight out of the household budget. That which used to be there for the household budget, for house mortgage, school fees, all of a sudden disappears. How do they make it up? By trying to increase their charges. And of course, those plumbers and electricians that don't have an apprentice in tow can often do the jobs then for cheaper.
Final question.
Of the older generation, it seems to me that looking back 30 years...
Are you directing that to me, no, of being of the older generation? Because it certainly doesn't apply to you.
67 years and 80s, and when we came on the war began with an experience of decades, protection, union dominance, whatever, industrial relations club, whatever. So we came off a crisis, and it took a decade or so to fix it. We're now in a different kind of scenario. And to what extent are the Labour leadership of a generation that having experienced the climate crisis, they're post-Whitlamite, they've absorbed the propaganda, and like Bill Shorten, they don't really understand what could happen if we don't go back to where we began 30 years ago?
Final response.
And that is why I suppose, if I can jump to another topic, the national curriculum should teach real history so that people actually learn what occurs. Or what has occurred even in our most recent history. It reminds me of being at the University of Tasmania addressing a student group. I think it was, just before the Howard government was elected, and I referred them to the interest payments on overdrafts of 21.7%. And they all laughed at me and thought I was engaging in this outrageous hyperbole. And I said, hang on a moment, don't you believe me? Of course not. And I knew that figure of 21.7% because that is what I was paying when my partner and I started up a Betts Curtis all those years ago during the Hawke Keating era. And people just, you know, young people don't even know what's been actually in their lifetime, albeit very early on. So the genuine history lessons do need to be taught, and if something sounds too good to be true, chances are it is, and we've just got to have these regular checks to ensure that we don't promise something to the next generation which is unsustainable. And at the moment I fear that they think everything can be sweet simply by borrowing, not realising that they'll be lumbered with the repayments and interest in the years to come. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the questions tonight, but it's right on 7 o'clock, so we have to finish. I just want to very briefly say thanks to Senator Abetz for a very thoughtful, documented, an important talk tonight with an announcement of an initiative and a very thorough handling of this significant issue over 3 decades. So no doubt we'll have you back in the future, but for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.